This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, the 17th of May, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, Pakistani officials demand an investigation after a NATO helicopter shoots and injures two Pakistani soldiers. The regime in the United Arab Emirates increases its crackdown on dissent, arresting activists, shutting down unions, and hiring a company run by Blackwater founder Eric Prince. And civil rights activists arrive in New Orleans, finishing the route of the Freedom Ride 50 years after the historic anti-segregation protests. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. After talks in Moscow today, Russia's foreign minister said Libyan officials agreed to abide fully to UN Resolution 1973, including a ceasefire, if NATO ends airstrikes and rebels agree to the same. But NATO airstrikes continued early today, and just yesterday, the opposition said they would not accept any such offers. There are more reports of high-level defection. While government spokesperson Musa Ibrahim denied just last night that oil minister Shukri Ghanem fled the country, a Tunisian official said he had in fact crossed the border. And today, Ibrahim announced that four detained journalists will be set free either today or tomorrow. He said all four, including James Foley of the Global Post and American freelancer Morgana Gillis, were in the country illegally. In Iran today, an official spokesperson said that Al Jazeera reporter Dorothy Parvaz, who has been missing since late April, was traveling on an expired Iranian passport. However, he did not reveal her whereabouts. Parvaz disappeared while traveling from Doha to Damascus to cover the pro-democracy uprising in Syria. Last week, Syrian officials said they deported her to Iran. In today's weekly address, the Iranian ministry also said that Parvaz had not applied for press credentials and was carrying multiple passports. Iran does not recognize dual citizenship. Parvaz reportedly holds triple citizenship in the U.S., Canada, and in Iran. Today is International Day Against Homophobia and Transphobia. This year's Hall of Shame includes American pastor Scott Lively and Ugandan lawmaker David Bahati. Lively has advocated for repressive anti-gay laws around the world, including in Uganda, where Bahati sponsored legislation that would have punished crimes of homosexuality by death. Israel's parliament passed a so-called slavery law yesterday that would allow severe restrictions on foreign migrant workers in nursing or caregiving professions. FSRN's Gillian Kessler-D'Amour has more.
Israeli lawmakers approved an amendment to the Nation's Entry Act that would allow the Interior Ministry to impose restrictions on migrant caretakers. The so-called slavery law allows new rules that could bind migrant caretakers to their employers, limit the number of times a worker can change employers, and restrict the laborers to a specific location inside Israel. These conditions would prevent migrant workers from leaving abusive employers and make it easier for the Israeli government to deport them from the country. Sigal Rosen works at the Hotline for Migrant Workers in Tel Aviv. She says that the new law is in clear violation of a 2006 Israeli Supreme Court ruling, which found that an earlier version of the legislation amounted to a modern form of slavery.
For 5 years, actually, Israel is violating the Supreme Court ruling. What they are doing now is making a law that will go around the Supreme Court ruling.
Rosen said that another appeal to the Israeli Supreme Court is likely when more practical details of the law become known in the coming weeks. Gillian Kessler-D'Amour, FSRN, Jerusalem.
Guatemalan President Alvaro Colom declared a state of emergency in the northern Petén department after he visited Finca Los Cocos, the site of Sunday's bloody massacre that left 27 people dead. Tim Russo reports.
The two survivors of the massacre, whose identities are being concealed for their safety, say that the aggressors decapitated the recently employed day laborers one by one because they could not respond when asked of the whereabouts of ranch owner Otto Salguero. Sunday's massacre, attributed to the Mexican drug cartel Zetas, is thought to be a revenge attack for the killing of a Zeta leader earlier in the week. Yesterday, the well-known tourist hub Santa Elena, near Guatemala's famous Tikal Mayan ruins, was virtually shut down during a 3-hour firefight led by Guatemala's police and military. Two people were killed and one was arrested. All were presumably linked to Sunday's massacre. The state of emergency limits constitutional rights, imposes a curfew, and will initially be implemented for 30 days. The U.S. State Department issued a travel alert today advising U.S. citizens to avoid travel to Guatemala. Tim Russo, FSRN, Alta Verapaz, Guatemala.
And in Botswana, the government fired striking emergency workers today. The doctors, nurses, and firefighters are among public sector employees who continue a month-long strike despite a court order mandating they return to work. Yesterday, all public schools across the country were closed indefinitely. Civil service workers are asking for a 17% raise. The government is only offering 5%. For Free Speech Radio News, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. Pakistani officials are demanding answers following an attack by NATO aircraft in North Waziristan that wounded two soldiers. There are conflicting reports about who fired first, and NATO says it's investigating. The incident comes as tensions are already high between the two countries following the US Special Forces raid that killed Osama bin Laden. In addition, many Pakistanis are strongly opposed to US drone strikes on terrorist targets, which have resulted in civilian deaths. U.S. Senator John Kerry is trying to smooth over relations, meeting yesterday with President Asif Ali Zardari and Prime Minister Yousaf Raza Gilani in Islamabad. At a hearing today on Capitol Hill, Kerry urged lawmakers to be careful and thoughtful about U.S. policy in the region.
I underscored the importance of seizing this moment to firmly reject an anti-American narrative that exploits our differences, instead of finding common ground and advancing mutual goals. I also listened carefully to the frustration that many in Pakistan are feeling about how we have been doing business together, about how the raid was conducted and perceived in terms of their politics and their ability to manage in Pakistan.
Kerry said after hours of talks, Pakistani leaders agreed to move forward jointly, but didn't provide further details. However, today's NATO attack on the Pakistani army post may exacerbate the military and political tensions. The US wants to maintain good relations, in part because Pakistan is a key supply route for delivering military supplies to Afghanistan. Pakistan officials also announced today they'd arrested an Al-Qaeda leader in Karachi. Muhammad Ali Qasim, also known as Abu Soheib al-Maki, is a Yemeni citizen. Military officials said he'd been operating along the border with Afghanistan. In the United Arab Emirates, there are growing signs that authorities are clamping down on dissent in the wake of the Arab Spring uprisings. Human rights groups are expressing concern over a crackdown on unions, and over the weekend, government officials confirmed they've contracted with a new company run by Eric Prince, founder of Blackwater. According to the New York Times, UAE paid Prince $500 million to train 800 foreign troops to quell internal dissent and protect oil pipelines. For more, we're joined by Sameer Muscati, UAE researcher at Human Rights Watch. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you for having me.
What do you see as the possible implications of Blackwater's successor company R2 being hired by the UAE regime?
We're very concerned. I think, given Blackwater's history in Iraq and other places, and the fact that they have not been accountable to grave crimes, it's quite a serious development. And looking at some of the reports that have come out in terms of what this force will be used for, including potentially quelling unrest at labor camps in the UAE, we're talking about migrant workers from India and Pakistan who are making very little money, and the fact that if they protest, they might be subjected to this force is quite alarming, actually.
Another area that the regime is cracking down on already is unions. And could you tell us a bit more about the teachers' union and what it was doing exactly that attracted the attention of the authorities?
Yeah, the Teachers Association is a long-standing organization in the UAE. They've been around since 1980. And basically, they're a collective of teachers, and basically the UAE authorities disintegrated the board of the association and replaced it with state-appointed members. And this is because they signed a petition or a public action asking for more democratic reforms. They're not the only association to face this. The Jurists Association, which is a collective of lawyers and jurists, also signed that same public action, and they also had the same fate where their board was gutted and taken over by UAE authorities.
To what extent do you see this as an increase, if you like, in the measures the regime's using to clamp down on dissent?
There's definitely been an uptick. They've widened the crackdown over the past 2 months. We've noted, even over the past few years, that activists face harassment from authorities. Websites have been shut down. But over the past 6 weeks, it's really been taken to a new level with the arrests of five activists, including one of our advisory committee members, Ahmed Mansour, who's a prominent human rights figure in the UAE. He's been arrested without charge, and he's being investigated along with the other activists for opposing the government and for basically insulting top officials. And they've shut down these prominent civil society organizations, the boards of these associations. And there's a real chill among the media who are covering these issues. From the local press, there's hardly been any critical coverage of this crackdown, and leads us to believe that local media are self-censoring themselves, and we're not optimistic about the weeks ahead.
I understand Ahmed Mansour was detained in early April. What's the latest you've heard on his situation?
He's still being held without charge, and he's still facing a criminal investigation for opposing the government and for insulting top officials. This is what the Attorney General announced on April 25th, about 3 weeks after he was, or 2.5 weeks after he was arrested. He has access to his lawyer, and his family has visited him. He has lost weight. We have made an appeal to the Attorney General to visit Ahmed, and we're still waiting for a response to see whether we'll be able to visit him or not. It's unlikely that they'll allow us to do so, but we're hopeful that they might give us an opportunity to see how he's doing.
Is it possible to compare the sorts of laws that the regime in the UAE uses to crack down on dissent with those in neighbouring Bahrain, where things have taken a serious turn for the worse? Is there a comparison to be made between those two regimes and the laws they use to crack down on dissent?
The situation obviously is a bit different in Bahrain, and it's an interesting comparison, since the UAE actually did send members of the security force to bolster the Bahraini monarchy during the turbulence that has happened there. But the UAE, in terms of the laws they have, the constitution actually does guarantee freedom of assembly and freedom of speech. But unfortunately, in the criminal code, the penal code, there are provisions. If people make disparaging comments, for instance, about the royal family or about the government, they are subject to criminal sanctions, including jail terms. So this is an issue that we've seen in the past, but we've never seen, I guess, so many activists who have been rounded up at the same time and potentially will be charged with these type of offenses. So it's on paper, even though the Constitution should be protective of people's rights, what we've seen in recent weeks is that the government is using laws to repress its population.
Have there been any sign of pro-democracy demonstrations in the UAE like there have been in Yemen and Bahrain?
No, there hasn't been. And most of the protests we've seen has been online, and people are asking for quite moderate things. They're not asking for a regime change. They're just asking for more freedom, for a chance to elect, to have a more elected, more representative body, a more representative parliament. We're not seeing a call for radical reform.
What would you like the international community to do about this?
I think the international community has an important role to play. We've seen the Crown Prince. He was in Washington just a few weeks ago as a guest of the White House. He attended the wedding in London for the royal family there. He is being treated as someone who deserves to have a red carpet. when in fact, we'd like to see international governments pressure the UAE to stop repressing activists, and not just governments, but also institutions, including New York University, Sorbonne, arts institutions, including the Guggenheim, the Louvre. All of these institutions have, contracts with the UAE. They're building branches there, and all of them have been silent, even though one of the activists is actually a lecturer for Sorbonne University in the UAE. None of these institutions have come to the defense of these activists and to civil society.
Sama Mascati, United Arab Emirates researcher for Human Rights Watch, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
First, they ignore you. Then they laugh at you. Then they fight you. Then you win.
I heard him say the revolution won't be televised. Al Jazeera proved him wrong. Twitter has him paralyzed. 80 million strong and ain't no longer gonna be terrorized. Organized.
When a pro-democracy movement took to the streets of the Arab world in December and January, many of its youth participants brought their change-inspiring music with them.
Yalla. El hip-hop el Masri. Al-Ajnabi.
Nigerian musician Fela Kuti said that music is the weapon of the future, and the critical lyrics and homegrown beats of Arab hip-hop played their own role in the so-called Arab Spring uprisings. FSRN plans to produce a documentary on the connection between hip-hop and the Arab uprisings, but we need your help. Visit fsrn.org to find out how you can support this project, Arab Hip-Hop, a soundtrack to the Arab Spring. In Indian-administered Kashmir over the weekend, thousands of people observed a general strike called by the political group the Hurriyat Conference. The group was calling for the release of political prisoners and youth, many of them children, arrested by the authorities. This follows growing outrage over the treatment of youth, many of whom are arrested at protests, face extended detentions, and are prosecuted as adults. From Srinagar, Shahnawaz Khan reports.
15-year-old Faizan Hakim is excited about the high school exams he has just passed. So is his family. Faizan's father, Rafiq Hakim, is thankful to God.
I am happy. It is a big joy for me. The second joy God has blessed me with.
The joy, which the poor fruit vendor describes, follows a very tough and turbulent time. Just a few weeks ago, Rafiq, a resident of Anantnag town in Indian administered Kashmir, was selling housewares to raise money to visit his son in a jail nearly 200 miles away. In February, police accused Faizan of taking part in stone pelting protesters and arrested him. The family secured bail from a local court, but police produced another case against him. Another bail was followed by another case, and the family secured bail a third time. And when the family was expecting his release, Faizan was booked under the infamous Public Safety Act, which allows for detention without a trial for up to 2 years. Faizan was moved to a jail in Jammu province, where he says it was difficult to adjust to the extremely hot climate.
I was wondering why they put me here. I thought I was confined for life. The sun was very hot there. It gave me headaches and I would get nosebleeds and vomit almost every day.
For his family, it was a very trying time. Faizan's mother, Naseema, says running into debt wasn't the only problem they faced.
We sold utensils and housewares to raise money for jail visits and trials. My younger son dropped out of school to help at his father's fruit stall as he was busy running around for Faizan's release.
The family's efforts to seek the release of their son on the basis of his age were unsuccessful, as authorities refused to entertain the date of the birth certificate issued by his school. It was only after Amnesty International took up his case and launched a campaign for his release that the government buckled. Now, as Faizan is back home, his mother is still worried about the criminal cases pending against him.
Please ask the government to withdraw the cases against him. I want him to focus on his studies. Please.
The Juvenile Justice Act of Indian Administered Kashmir demands that minors like Faizan be tried in juvenile boards, under juvenile acts, and housed in special juvenile houses. But none of that is happening. The situation prompted social activist and lawyer A.R. Hanjura to go to court in 2009.
The infrastructure under the rules and under the provisions of Act were not available in the state, and still this infrastructure is not available within the state. Neither there are the juvenile homes, nor there are the observation homes, nor there are the special homes for the rehabilitation of these juvenile delinquents.
In June 2010, the court directed the government to come up with juvenile facilities within 3 months. But while the government slept over the issue, it has been proactive in detaining juveniles, especially as Indian administered Kashmir has been rocked by widespread street protesters in the last 3 years. Local rights activist Parvez Imroz says a good number of people arrested by authorities in the clampdown include children.
According to government statement, is 5,255 were arrested last year. And out of that, I think we believe that half of them would be the juveniles, meaning who are less than 18 years of age. So not only they are being arrested, but they are also being tortured in the police stations.
Last year, a group of children alleged in a court that they were beaten up and forced to sodomize each other while in a police lockup. With this new wave of arrests, Imroz says, the government is trying to prevent a repeat of street protesters like the ones last year that resulted in more than 120 dead, most of them teens.
Important thing is the way there's an indiscriminate arrest of the juveniles, because government is very apprehensive. There should not be repetition of 2010, which was a nightmare for the government. And they are taking the preemptive measures and are being arresting young people.
Rights groups like Amnesty International and Save the Children say that the Juvenile Act of Indian Administered Kashmir needs major improvements. The current act defines boys above 16 as adults, while in rest of India, the cut-off age is 18. Muhammad Sharif Bhatt, state manager of Save the Children, says the government has promised to revise its law in line with the Indian Juvenile Justice Act.
So we are hope that in a coming assembly, the act will be passed. And also that CM have agreed that soon they will come up with a center at par with a center act, while we have conducted a training to the officials of police officials on JJ Act.
Activist Hanjura welcomes the government's promise to update the act, but points out that the government hasn't even acted on court directions to meet requirements of current act. Now he plans to go to court again. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Rides, in which civil rights activists, black and white, took buses from Washington, D.C. to the South to challenge racial segregation. Although the Supreme Court had ruled that segregation on public transport was unconstitutional, the participants faced violent resistance. After one bus was bombed in Alabama and the riders of another severely beaten in Birmingham, the ride was halted before reaching its final destination, New Orleans. Yesterday, some of the original riders and a new group completed the last leg of the journey. Zoe Sullivan has more.
The organizers of the Freedom Rides wanted participants to be prepared for any verbal and physical violence they would face along the route. So many of the riders were trained in New Orleans in advance of the trip by civil rights activist Doty Smith Simmons.
They were sitting in a chair. We would knock the chair over and they would fall to the floor. We would spit on them. We would slap them. If you are white, we call you nigger lover. If you are black, we call you nigger. And bump into you. You know, the things that was done to us. But they could not fight back. They had to learn to take it.
Smith Simmons worked with the Congress on Racial Equality in New Orleans during the Civil Rights Movement. 50 years after her work, training activists in nonviolent resistance, Smith-Simmons gathered with roughly 500 others at the Ashe Cultural Center in New Orleans to mark the completion of the Freedom Rides. As the Freedom Bus arrived at its final stop, the crowd cheered and a brass band welcomed the riders. Later, doves were released to commemorate activists who had passed away. Solomon Skip Alexander was one of many longtime civil rights activists in the crowd.
I hope I don't cry. It's so emotional, and it means a lot because some of us didn't make it at Anniston. Some got just outright killed, and then some in Anniston, the prison, got beat up badly, you know, so it's not a joy. I think of all those who didn't make it.
The rides were organized to test a 1960 Supreme Court ruling outlawing segregation in public transportation. This decision overturned the late 19th century Plessy versus Ferguson ruling, which said that blacks could be restricted to separate but equal accommodations. Homer Plessy was a light-skinned New Orleanian who was arrested as he attempted to integrate a passenger train. During Monday's event to welcome the riders, one woman held a placard with photos documenting the violence 50 years ago. In one image, smoke pours from a bombed bus. In another, white men beat a participant who is pinned to the ground. Because of the violent attacks and mass arrests, no bus driver would take the riders past Jackson, Mississippi, so organizers ended the ride before it got to New Orleans. But part of this month's anniversary events included finishing the route. In addition to honoring the original riders, this Freedom Ride welcomed a new group of activists. 40 college students from around the country were selected from 1,000 applicants to complete the ride with some of the original group. One young rider wore a hijab, showing her Muslim faith.
My name is Dua Dorgum. I'm a junior at North Carolina State University.
Dorgum, a psychology major, talked about the meaning she sees today in the Freedom Rides.
I think it's inspired me because when you're interacting with older generations that have so much hope in you, you begin to believe it. And I think the problem with apathy of our generation is the fact that we don't have communication with older generations. But when you have people that change the United States telling you that you can and believing in you, it definitely has re-energized me to continue doing change and to continue to break these negative stereotypes that are associated with Muslims in America.
The event was organized by PBS in conjunction with the airing of a new documentary on the Freedom Rides. In addition to honoring the original Freedom Riders, it gave young and seasoned activists an opportunity to learn from each other. Carol Beeble, co-founder of the Ashe Cultural Arts Center, says that's important because civil rights work is far from done.
So today, riding on the bus is not the issue. Today, it's education in jails. Today, the places that are barriers to democracy are really what we are not doing in terms of school, what we are not doing in terms of justice. And I think that being forced in a certain kind of way to step back into that place hopefully will remind us of how far we've come and how far we still have to go.
At the ceremony, young people crowded the original riders to listen to their stories. Two middle schoolers who attended said speaking with people who had lived history transformed what they had previously learned from textbooks. Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, New Orleans.
And for today's program, that's it. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.